The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's almost about that time, right about now.
Right about now. Right about now.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Right About Now. I'm your host, Jonathan Small. It is a pleasure, as always, to have you with me. My guest today is Maria Gudovich, the author of the new book, Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. Now, Maria started her career as a newspaper journalist. She worked at USA Today and San Francisco Chronicle, among other publications. But at a certain point in her career, she transitioned to writing about dogs. And she's going to talk to us all about that, because that decision changed the entire trajectory of her career. Maria has written several best-selling books about dogs, including Soldier Dogs, about the heroic dogs in Afghanistan and Iraq, Top Dog, about one particularly heroic dog, and Secret Service Dogs, about the dogs that protect our presidents. Her new book is all about dogs who help people in the medical field, dogs that sniff cancer, and dogs that sniff out diabetes when people are having highs, dogs that are able to sniff out cancer before even the doctors detect it, and dogs that are able to tell their humans whether they're going through diabetic highs or lows, or dogs that comfort people with extreme anxiety or depression, dogs that calm down people with autism. It's a beautiful book. And Maria is an incredible writer in that her background as a reporter makes her an expert researcher. And she is a very descriptive writer and has done her research. And she talks to me a lot in this interview about how she researches and some of her tips for researching, especially under very tight deadlines. Apparently, she only had 4 months to write her first book, Soldier Dogs, which went on to become a New York Times bestseller. Okay, so no excuses. And I'm actually talking to myself right here. If Maria can write a book in 4 months, then I have no excuse for not writing a book in 1 year, or whatever artificial deadline I give myself. Anyway, I really enjoy talking to Maria. She has a great passion for dogs and for people and for great human stories and for great stories. Now, I will admit I am a cat person, but I love my dogs too. Where are my dogs at? Woof, woof, woof. So Maria Gudovich, welcome to Right About Now.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you on the show, and I really enjoyed reading this book. And I will admit that I'm more of a cat person than a dog person, although I do adore dogs, because how could you not? And after this book, reading this book, it made me like dogs even more, and made me, at some points, it kind of put a little lump in my throat. It's very sweet. I mean, kind of just amazing what dogs can do and how much they help people.
No, it is. It is absolutely. It still amazes me after these years of research and all this writing. I still am just so mesmerized by the fact that they can do these. I just watch them with my jaw down whenever I see them being able to do some of the things I wrote about in the book. It's just so beautiful, and really, it just demonstrates just a fraction of what our bond is all about with
them. Yeah. And you can really tell your love for dogs in the way you write about them, and you really make them characters in your story. They're not just sort of like secondary figures. So let's talk a little bit about your career. Such an interesting career. So you began as a newspaper reporter and staff writer, right, at places like USA Today and the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah.
When did you start writing about dogs? How did that come into your experience?
Yeah, it was actually when I was freelancing for the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle. They had me. This was in the 80s, so it was a long time ago. It was still, you know, relatively formative stages of my career as a writer or newspaper reporter, and they asked me to do a story on it was a really boring story. I didn't want to do, oh, place, have a picnic in the Bay Area. And I said, if I come up with something better, it was for a big special summer edition. I said, if I come something up with more interesting, could you listen to me? And they said, sure. I had just gotten a dog named Joe. He was in Airedale. And I was in places that I could go with him very easily. And so I said, what about a sort of big, long article on places to take a dog in the Bay Area? And so I did that. It was the whole page, the whole front page of that section and a page inside. And it was really popular to the point where an editor at the Chronicle said, hey, you know, would you like to co-author a book? Should we do a book on this subject? So we ended up co-authoring the Bay Area Dog Lover's Companion. And she was with me for a couple of editions, but it's so much work. She left me with it after a couple of editions to update. And that became a California-wide book. So it was 1,000 pages that I was having to update every couple of years or so on great places, parks, recreation areas, beaches, restaurants, hotels, all kinds of really entertainment venues that allow dogs. And we would give them ratings, 1 to 4 paws or 5 paws.
Aww.
And really popular. A lot of people here.
It seems sort of ahead of its time, too. Yeah.
It was. Like, I was just sort of at the beginning of that wave, and that's why the book started out a little shorter, but then I kept having to be really, really picky about what would get in the book, because there became so many hotels allowing dogs and so many things that were so rare in the beginning. So it's a testament to how our dogs have been much more integral in our lives, even than when I started the book, and certainly than when I was growing up. We've always loved dogs as people, but now it's just really gone up so many notches. And that eventually, I was working at USA Today at the time. I had my human child, and I decided to get out of news altogether, and I started relying more on the books. I became an editor at Dogster.com, which was a really big website, while doing some freelance writing of various sorts. And I'd written a book on babies and sleep with a pediatrician, and when I had a baby who needed to get sleep.
Oh, boy.
But then in 2011, there was this raid on the Osama bin Laden compound that you've definitely heard about.
Mm-hmm.
And Navy SEAL Team 6 went in, and they went in with a military dog. And I was so surprised, because there were headlines everywhere. Yeah, Osama bin Laden was caught and all that. But there were so many headlines also about the fact that there was a dog. People were shocked that there were dogs in the military. Now, I wasn't at all surprised, because I'd been doing stories on them for Dogster. And more than that, I grew up with a dad who was 18 years old when he was drafted for World War II. And he was a homesick kid, and he was out there in war. And he would tell me later in life, when he was saying about the dogs being able to save the troops by day and save souls at night. And he was that kid that, you know, the dog would go to, and they'd know he was feeling bad or whatever, and they'd snuggle up to him, or someone else who was having a bad day, someone whose girlfriend had just broken up with them because they were gone too long or whatever, and the dog seemed to know. And I decided at that point, with the bin Laden raid and everything, I said, you know what, I think I need to do this book that I've been thinking about doing for a long time. And it was very, very fortuitous that at that same time, I got a call from an agent who said, would you be interested in doing a book on military dogs? I said, funny you should say that.
Yeah.
I already had an agent for my baby book. So they actually split doing the agent work. And we had an extremely short deadline. It was ridiculous, but that's how I got a good advance, was to say yes to that particular offer from Dutton, which is now Dutton Penguin Random House, and I had to turn around that book really quickly. I didn't go to Afghanistan or Iraq. I stayed here, but I traveled all over the U.S. meeting with all these dog handlers, Marine dog handlers, Air Force, even Navy, and certainly Army at different bases. I watched their training. It was great. So that became a book, Soldier Dogs, and it became a New York Times bestseller, thanks to Jon Stewart, I think, because I was on his show.
Welcome back, a former newspaper reporter, now the news editor for Dogster.com. Her new book is called Soldier Dogs, The Untold Story of America's Canine Heroes. Please welcome to the program, Maria Gudovich. Hello. Nice to see you. Please sit. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, that was good.
That really helped get it a lot of visibility. And then my next books just happened to be about dogs again. Along the way of learning about these dogs, I learned about a dog named Luca. When I talked to her handler to research more about a dog in the book Soldier Dogs, he told me that his dog was currently with someone else, and he missed his dog and what a great dog he had. Then, a little bit later, I came to find out the headlines were this dog had been hurt by an IED in Iraq. Oh, no, this was in Afghanistan. And she ended up losing her leg, and she was a hero. She kept wanting to work. She was retired, and she was reunited with this man. Now, I thought, now there's a book in this, because there's such good people, such good characters. There were Green Berets involved, and she led more than 400 missions and using her nose to clear areas of IEDs, of these makeshift bombs, and no one ever got hurt. She was the only one who ever got hurt, and she found so many of these IEDs along the way and caches of weapons, and she became the topic of my next book called Top Dog. And then continuing along those lines, I started thinking about the Secret Service. There was a presidential election coming up, and I thought, what a good time to have a book about the dogs of the Secret Service. Can I get in? It took about 9 months for them to say yes. I could have had a baby in that time, but then that made my deadline shorter, so I didn't have all that much time to put it together. At the time, we had no idea that there would be a Donald Trump involved, and so my book came out just before the election, which was not great for publicity. You would think it would be normally in a normal presidential election. Great, let's have a tie-in here.
Yeah.
But the dogs were so busy that no one could interview with me, and there were very few interviews to be had because the attention was focused in a very different place.
Right.
So then that led me to this new book where people are available and there are no crazy presidential elections in my book.
Yeah.
So that was really helpful. We're off and running. I'm really excited.
No, that's awesome. So you never, it was sort of almost like a happy accident. You didn't set off to write the series of heroic dog books. It was sort of like you, to use a terrible pun, sort of sniffed out stories each time you were working on one book, or was there sort of like a 4-book deal? You're going to do books on dogs for...
No, not at all. Not at all. It was Soldier Dogs, and guess how long I had to do that book?
Tell me.
I had 4 months.
Four months
to research it.
That's crazy.
To research and write it. So I was doing 18-hour days, sometimes 21-hour days, and traveling all over the place. And it's really hard to break into the military as well to get the okay.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And there are a couple places where I didn't. Marines didn't say yes. But there's a guy, Gunny Knight, who was really cool. He's a big character in my book, and he was the top dog guy in as part of the Marines, the top dog handler and trainer. And he said, "You know what? There's black, there's white, and I live in the gray. So you come out here to Yuma, Arizona, and I'm going to show you what we do." So that was great. You get to see the dogs in the element. They have these mock villages that are supposed to be like just sort of generic Middle East villages. They had all kinds of things. They had shrines and the noises of the call to prayer. They had certainly the weather. It was incredibly hot and dry. So they mimic these conditions so that people can get used to it. It's pre-deployment training. But anyway, that was great. And just to have to do that with such a short deadline. But it was the way that we got the book deal, and I said I could do it, and I delivered, which was amazing. I would never, ever recommend that to anybody. But fortunately, working for USA Today, I was used to fast research because I'm on the West Coast, and we have early deadlines, and you know, newspaper work makes it go fast. So
tell me, so you're obviously an impeccable researcher, very good researcher. To do that in 4 months is unbelievable. So what did you learn in all those years of training at USA Today and at different newspapers you worked at? How did you get so much information? And I mean, do you have any sort of secret weapons that you can share with us about that?
I would just say you just keep going and going to get one person who can help you. And that person will introduce you to other people who will introduce you to other people. You don't necessarily have to go through the official channels in those kinds of cases. And that's what happened with us. someone named, we call him A-Rod in the book, but he is a dog handler and trainer in the Air Force. He was awesome. I think one of the guys put me in touch with him, and then he put me in touch. He got me to get into places. He greased the wheels, and I was able to just sort of get into these other places to see this happening. They knew what I was up against. And so everybody wanted to talk about their dogs. Every handler who heard about this opportunity wanted to tell me their story. And so that was great. I did have the choice of going to Afghanistan at one point, but it would have taken a lot of clearance, a two-week window to get there, at least 2 weeks there, and 2 week window to get back. When you're talking 4 months, that doesn't happen. But I turned it in on time. I am amazed I survived that whole thing, and I will never do that again. My next book, I had 6 months. So
six, yeah, six
that was
months.
Easier,
okay.
Though,
yeah.
Yeah. No, this last book. Oh, what a luxury.
What did you have? So let's talk about Dr. Dog. So first of all, what inspired this idea to come up with a whole book about?
Well, you know, it was just another use of the working dog, and what this new job for working dogs is. It's very new. It's this way of utilizing their sense of smell and you know, really working on the bond with the dogs. And I've been working with dogs who save lives. I've been writing about them. They save lives by virtue of the bond and of their noses, sniffing out the bombs. And this is just a natural next step. How else are they saving lives? This is after my book about the Secret Service. What other ways? And so when I heard about the research going on in Japan on stomach cancer in this town up there, I thought, that's interesting. And then I heard about more of that and more, and I started researching, digging into studies that are ongoing that hadn't been published yet. And I thought, this is my book. So being that I've been with my same editor for three books, I still had to write a proposal, but it was short. It was relatively short, but it was pretty compelling, I guess. So I signed on with my editor at Dutton for this fourth book, and this one was really great. I got to travel for. I went around the world, and
yeah.
I went to the best places, the most compelling stories, the most cutting science.
And you met some incredible dogs along the way.
I did.
Yeah, there's some beautiful stories.
And I love their stories. And I was choking back tears half the time because these people's lives were just so difficult before their dogs, and still difficult oftentimes. But their dogs had really saved them from this darkness, from their illnesses that are sometimes so hard to diagnose. Dogs were helping people whose doctors couldn't figure out what was going on with them. Like this one young man, Paul with his dog Koira, he was having mysterious paralysis episodes and then dystonias where his muscles would all cramp up and like Charlie horses, and he was in such pain. So these opposite things where he would just suddenly go into paralysis, and they were told, oh, it's a migraine, some kind of migraine. So they heard that there were migraine alert dogs. They worked with they got a dog from a breeder who's really good at service dog breeding, and they worked with a trainer who is really good at medical dog training, and remotely they worked with her, and they were able to get the dog to alert to him before he had a paralysis episode or a dystonia episode. Two separate alerts. They just would have him spit basically onto a cotton ball every half hour, and then right, the one that comes closest to his attack, they would keep, and they would propagate that and make other samples from it and train the dog on that. So that happened. The dog was really good. It took a lot of training. It's not easy, and she can alert to these things, and she saved him. She can tell him before he goes down. He's going to college now. He has had a couple of surgeries. It turns out it wasn't migraines at all. It was something related to his Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a pretty severe, in his case, collagen disorder, and his brainstem was being crushed. So he's had some operations that have helped immensely, but his dog is still alerting to the occasional paralysis episodes.
So what is your understanding of how the dogs can sense the paralysis or these different things, diabetic highs and lows, before they happen? Like, how are they so tuned into humans that they're able to do that?
Well, you know, they get the training. So there are dogs who sort of freelance figure it out. There have been dogs of people with seizures who have been able to, they start getting anxious 10 minutes before a seizure happens. And so the people come to associate the dog's anxiety with their seizure. And sure enough, whoa, I did have a seizure. So that's that. And maybe they can train the dog to do a more proper alert at that time. But most of the dogs that I'm talking about are really, really, really well trained. And we don't know what they're smelling. We don't know. We just give them the scent. So for the diabetic, they would do a swab with gauze on person's skin, on the skin of someone who's having a diabetic low, for instance. And they would train the dog, hey, associate this scent with something really good. And many, you know, they would give many, many samples. And then even at one place, they swabbed my skin and used that as a control. This is a person who doesn't have diabetes. And so the dog would learn, and it's all fun and games. It's not that the dog knows, I'm detecting cancer, I'm going to save people, you know, in a research setting, or, yes, this scent means that I'm saving Mary from her next diabetic low. It does come to that after a while, but at first it's all fun and games. Like, oh, I smell the scent, and that means treats,
yeah.
And so that's what it is, at least at first. But the dogs who work directly with the people, like the dogs I was talking about just now, I have to believe that there's love involved there after a while. That bond is so deep, and they love their person. They don't want to see the person suffer, and they know that when they do this, the person gets really, really happy, and they love that. My dog wants to make me happy, except when he's tearing up his bed. But it's a beautiful thing. It's the bond, and it's also the reward that they're getting, and it's just such an uplifting story. Dogs love to work. Dogs love to have a job. I try to give my dog a job every so often, but they love this, and the dogs thrive on this. And some dogs even wake up in the middle of sleep to alert their person to a seizure or a diabetic low. And I don't know how they do it. Someone said it's kind of like when you're sleeping and you smell bacon or coffee cooking, then brewing, that sort of gets into your brain. But bacon and coffee are one thing for us, but if you're trained that that this scent of a diabetic low, you'll get not only treat, but so much love, and you're going to mean so much to this person. You know, some dogs are able to just do this, and they go right back to sleep. It's not like they're sleep deprived, but
right.
they do work hard, and they are so devoted to their people. We were just on the Today Show, and a young man who has a diabetic alert dog was sitting talking to the interviewer, and his dog just had her head on his lap a lot of the time, and it was so sweet. And she actually alerted on camera, which was pretty amazing.
Wow.
So we got to see this happen. Sure enough, his blood sugar was going down pretty steadily.
Oh boy. Well, so talk to me about, there's some dogs though that haven't necessarily been trained, but just have this instinct. Like you talk about this story about this dog that keeps sniffing its person's ankle and kind of licking it and stuff, and that alerted her, right? Tell that story that's in the book.
Okay, I think you're talking about the heart attack one.
Yes.
So,
There was the melanoma,
so
there was a melanoma one, and there was also a heart attack one. But, yeah,
and there was a cancer one too, and where the dog kept nudging the person's breast, and when she got it checked out, there was breast cancer there, and the dog had never done that before and didn't do it after she was treated. So, but this one dog, a man I talked to, was using his dog for PTSD. The dog was really helpful in mitigating some of his anxieties that come along with PTSD, and the dog started doing this strange thing where she would start licking the inside wrist, so like licking his wrist on the inside part where his palm is, just licking it as if there were peanut butter there, and she was trying to get it off. And he didn't know what this was, but then after that, he would have angina, heart pain, and he hadn't had that before. The first time she did this, and then he had this angina, and he didn't really associate it at all. It took two or three times, and he realized, oh my God, this is happening. And one time, she was vigilant. She was following him around. They lived on a huge boat, and she was following him around the boat, and he was completely winded going to the top of some stairs, and he had to sit in a chair, and she just got his wrist and was licking, and looking at him, and actually he drove himself to the hospital. He felt something's wrong. This dog is telling me something, and I'm not feeling well. And he had had a heart attack.
Mm.
So he's had some medical processes done, so he's not having these angina attacks anymore or heart attacks. So the dog was somehow, no one knows how, but the fact that it's at the wrist where, you know, you can sort of smell maybe more blood close there, maybe she was sensing something was off. So something. I'm thinking that the dogs who are smelling the cancers on their people, you know, Baby Boo who sniffed at her person's melanoma, and cats are doing this too sometimes. I have cats in a footnote, so you should be happy about that as a cat person.
I was going to ask you about that, but let's talk about, yeah, so they sniff out these.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. Yeah. But they are smelling something just weird and wrong, and maybe they're smelling something necrotic. Maybe it's dying tissue. We don't know what it is, and science is working really hard to find out what that is, and they're working with the dogs to get to the bottom of this. So one day we'll have some technology that will tell us more about what it is.
It's amazing. And the other thing that was so intriguing about your book are the psychiatric service dogs. So, you know, there's the dogs that can sniff out cancer and kind of use their noses to sniff out different, you know, maybe the sweat or whatever they're smelling that alerts them to alert their humans that something might be coming or that something is wrong. But then you have these psychiatric service dogs that maybe it's not about smell as much as it's just about some sort of connection they have. And you tell... Oh, first of all, there's this cute, skinny greyhound dog in your book, Gable, I think, that was like this kind of like failed race dog. Yeah. Okay. And then he has this beautiful relationship. Can you talk to us a little bit about that relationship? It was so touching, I thought.
Yeah. So this young woman has severe anxiety. She was actually subsequently diagnosed with bipolar and some other mental health issues, mental illnesses. And she was so anxious, she couldn't function in the world. And she started hearing about dogs for anxiety. And this was in Arizona. And she asked to get a dog. What they do, this organization has part of it that gets dogs from shelters or dogs who are being given up. For like this greyhound was in a racing situation. The greyhound didn't have the stellar career that he needed. I actually looked up his racing record and was able to incorporate that into the story. It actually turned out really well. And the greyhound, he wasn't a winner, and he just kind of came into her life, and she thought, a greyhound? Are you kidding? How is this going to help me? Well, it turns out he was the best thing that could have happened to her. He's very calm. He is so calm, and he's big. So when they're out and about, she's able to just reach down when she's feeling anxious and touch him. He has been trained to, in crowded situations, if she says a certain word, he will, or she doesn't even have to say it now, he goes in between. He will be a buffer between her and wherever the biggest crowd is. He'll just go between them so she's not touched by people when she's in an anxiety mode. He can help lead her out of crowded situations when she says exit. He'll kind of go to wherever he came from, where he knows to get her out of there. Or he'll just settle with her, and he knows to lean into her because it's very grounding, as it is for people with PTSD. The dogs are trained to put their heads really hard in their lap, or if the person wants to sit down, the dog will just drape across them, or whatever it takes for the dog to connect to the person, actually really physically. And sometimes for her, it's just being able to reach down. She doesn't have to reach far because he's an enormous dog, and touch him, and that completely takes it away. And it's helped with bipolar. Of course, she's on medications as well, but she's doing well. She's taking some college classes now, and her dog is amazing. And, you know, he wasn't a winner, as I said, on the track, but as she says, he is such a winner in her life. So he has this whole new life, and he's so happy, and he's so calm. When I interviewed her, we went to a mall together to see how he does with people and in crowds and how she does, but we also had lunch together. He just walked in and made himself a tight little ball underneath the table and went to sleep. No one even knew he was there. Yeah, he's a great service dog.
And dogs are also been helpful for people with autism. You have that story of Matt Lamott there, and why is that? Why do we think that they are help children and adults with autism?
Yeah, and it's, you know what, just having a dog can be helpful, but especially trained dog is really important in this kind of situation usually, because I've talked with people who have gotten pets to try to mitigate their child's, some of their symptoms when it comes to meltdowns or anxiety, and that the dog is sometimes more hyper, and sometimes dogs, even as the case in the book, the family, while waiting for a service dog, got a pet dog, and it didn't work out at all. The pet dog actually started having fears of loud noises, which was not helpful to the little boy. This family in the book waited 4 years to get the dog, and the dog is such a good example of how these really, really well-trained dogs can be such a huge life changer. They're not necessarily using their noses, although some of these dogs are able to tell ahead of the time when someone is about to start getting extremely anxious and maybe acting out. And so they'll try to come in and calm the child right away. And the dog seems to know before things happen and can calm I'm talking about Matthew now, across the board. These dogs are trained to go in and, just as I said, with anxiety, put the weight on the child. Maybe the child will lie down in the middle of the aisle in Target and just hold their dog. And that just stops this anxiety and, you know, what people see as meltdowns. People think the child is throwing temper tantrums. They don't realize the child is just overstimulated and it truly is too much for their systems.
So they calm them down.
The dog just stops that. Yeah. But the dog, these kinds of dogs have to be of a very calm and hearty type. They can't, because there's going to be yelling, there's going to be screaming, some children lash out, and depending on how they normally react. And dogs, you know, the parents are there when the dog's there in that case. And the dogs, you know, can't be hurt. Children don't seem to lash out at the dogs. But the dogs need to be calm. They need to have a lot of their own time in cases like this. They need to rest. So that's a really different case where dogs can get tired. But this boy, Matthew, in the book, and other people I've talked to, he was not able to go to the doctor, the dentist, to get a haircut. It's all too much for his sensory, what he's going through. And haircuts would feel painful, like little pins and needles coming down on his shoulders. The noise of the clippers was too much. His mother would have to hold him, have her sit on him, and restrain him if he went to the dentist or the doctor. It was
the dog calmed him down.
The dog came in, completely changed that. He has the dog in the chair with him. He's calm. He's great. He never used to be able to go to restaurants at all. They had takeout menus. That was the restaurants. He loves going to restaurants. Lloyd's there. Lloyd is under the table, and all is well. The whole family's life was able to change.
So we have one more minute. I want to talk about cats, because how do they help? Because my cat, I always call my cat a therapy cat, because he just, whenever I'm stressed, he comes over and cuddles next to me. But what are they finding scientifically that cats can do?
Well, there's not a lot of research going on about cats in the same realm, in the same way there are about dogs. But they do turn out to be pretty good detectors if they decide to be. It's all on their terms, right?
Yeah.
There are some notable exceptions of this. There are highly trainable cats. We all know that. But cats turn out to have certain olfactory anatomy that rivals dogs in some ways. It's not necessarily better than dogs, but certain parts of their olfaction are better. But, you know, because cats are cats, it might be a long time before I write a book called Clinician Cats.
but you already have a name, so that's good.
Yeah, I do. I do. They've been documented to warn their people of low blood sugars. They are doing it themselves. They decide to do this. And some cats will just walk in a room and wake up the person, or they'll just come up to them and just stare at them and kind of pound on them. There's one dog who tried to tell the man that he was having a diabetic low. He does this thing where he kind of paws at him, he scratches at him, he looks and looks and looks, tries to get him, but the man went unconscious. So the cat went and got the girlfriend and he woke her up and brought her in, and the man was in a coma. So the cat saved his life. Something that is potential, but I really don't think we're going to be seeing a lot of cats used in this potential.
I mean, my cat, I always say my cat identifies as a dog. So I have one of those, you know, a trans pet who basically thinks a cat who really basically wants to be a dog. So maybe that's probably why he's so helpful to me. So last,
he sounds great. Name.
His name is Seymour. Last question. Best writing advice you ever got in your life, or the best advice you like to give aspiring writers or writers?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. You only have like 15 seconds.
I know. It's a whole other interview.
So this is my advice, because I tend to procrastinate, and even when I have deadlines. So just do it. Just sit there, motivate yourself, and just know, like, you sit down and you write every day, and do it. Do not use excuses. Turn off email. Just focus on that. Give yourself a break every hour if you need to, whatever works for you. But do it, and, you know, by the end of the day, you'll feel good, and you will accomplish something. Because I would be like, oh, yeah, I could do this, but, you know, I should clean the refrigerator or something, or let me check my email. But really, really, I guess just kept saying to yourself, you got this. Just sit here. It's painful now, but you'll get rewarded later. And so stick with it. Don't give up.
Well, you're a testament to that. 4 months, and you just went for it. 18-hour days.
I didn't have a choice.
You didn't have a choice. Deadlines help. Deadlines help writers, for sure.
Yeah, they help a lot. And just pretend. The other thing is pretend you have a deadline. I pretended my deadline for this book was shorter than it is, because they always are. And so that really helped motivate me. I couldn't fool myself on some days, but it really was helpful. Just stick at it. Sit at the computer and write something. And even if it's two words, it will lead to a paragraph. It will lead to a lot more.
Well, Maria, that's such great advice. Thank you for writing this beautiful book, and best of luck with it.
Oh, thank you so much, John. It was nice talking with
you. Nice talking to you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Write About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, writeaboutnowmedia.com, and listen there. This is Ella reminding you to
do the right thing.
Thanks, Ella.
You're welcome.
Perfect.